Dia de los Muertos celebration on Friday, November 1st, and Saturday, November 2nd, from 4 to 9 p.m. at St. Andrew Catholic Church in Portland. This two-day event celebrates the ancient tradition of welcoming back loved ones who have passed on. There will be altar building, Muertos face painting, sugar skull decorating, traditional Mexican food, drink, and live musical performances. It's a benefit for Transiciones, a program at Mount Hood Community College that has helped Latino women for close to 20 years in reaching their academic and career goals. Again, that's a Muertos PDX Dia de los Muertos celebration on Friday, November 1st and Saturday, November 2nd from 4 to 9 p.m. at St. Andrew Catholic Church, 806 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 5 o'clock. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a new study from OHSU finds transgender and non-binary Oregon youth still face major challenges in accessing proper medical care.
A conference in Washington State will explore the possibility for a high-speed railway in the Northwest.
And EPA regulation rollbacks are an insufficient lifeline for the dying coal industry.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 1st, 2019. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm Althea Billings. Transgender and non-binary young people in Oregon still face significant challenges in accessing the medical care they need. That's according to a new report from OHSU based on analysis of a survey of 194 trans and non-binary people ages 13 to 21 across the state. A majority of these respondents, 77%, had never received any trans-specific medical care. The top two reasons given for why they had not sought out treatment were "my parents don't support it" and "insurance doesn't cover it." The survey showed that, in particular, trans and non-binary youth outside the Portland metro area have difficulty finding experienced medical care where they live. While the state of Oregon requires insurance providers to cover transition-related procedures, those are largely restricted to youth over the age of 18. An alternative for younger people is hormone blockers, which trans kids can start taking as adolescents to delay the onset of puberty and the development of secondary sex characteristics that don't align with their gender identity. Blockers, however, aren't covered by most insurance plans, and without insurance, they are cost prohibitive for the average Oregon family. This survey is the first of its kind in Oregon, and the insights will help inform medical and advocacy efforts across the state.
A high-speed rail line connecting Portland, Seattle, and Vancouver, BC may be in the works. Next week, transportation officials and rail expansion advocates will be meeting at Microsoft's headquarters in Seattle to discuss creating a high-speed rail line to connect the cities. The advocacy group Cascadia Rail envisions a train that travels at a speed of approximately 217 miles per hour, which would make the trip between Vancouver and Seattle just an hour long. The Cascadia Rail Summit, as it's been called, will explore how the high-speed rail line would impact housing affordability, transportation emissions, and job creation. Washington Governor Jay Inslee will be attending, as will ODOT Rail and Public Transit Administrator Hal Gard. The most recent analysis out of the Washington State Department of Transportation shows the rail line costing over $40 billion. The funding mechanism for the project is still unclear. Microsoft has long been a proponent of expanded rail use, even funding a Washington State Department of Transportation study on the feasibility of such a line in 2018. Microsoft President Brad Smith told the Daily Hive last year the project would be transformative to the regional economy. Quote, our ability to compete in the world's economy will be enhanced dramatically by having a region that is 6 million inhabitants strong versus two or three regions of 3 million each. End quote.
The Environmental Protection Agency will release rules in the coming weeks intended to relax regulations that reduce the amount of toxic ash emitted by coal power plants in waterways. The planned rules would weaken Obama-era protections that increased inspections at coal plants, lowered the amount of plant discharge that was allowed, and required new tech to protect water supplies from contamination. A source close to the EPA told the New York Times that the deregulation would actually result in less contaminants in the water, but that math was based on an existing 30% of coal plants voluntarily introducing new expensive technology. Pollutants like these can cause birth defects, cancer, and stunted brain development in young children. Analysts have judged the move as a last-ditch effort to save the dying coal industry, as the EPA director, Andrew Wheeler, was a lobbyist for the coal industry. 8 coal energy companies have filed for bankruptcy this year as the demand has shifted away from coal to cheaper renewable sources. Joshua Rhodes, a senior energy analyst with the Vibrant Clean Energy, told the New York Times, quote, while it might keep some existing coal plants running a little bit longer, it's at best a band-aid on a bullet wound that the market has sent the coal industry.
Across the country, pesticide use is endangering species, including the Northwest Chinook salmon and the orcas that feed on them. Rollbacks on pesticide regulations at the federal level could make the issue worse. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has more.
The wide use of pesticides is pushing some species in Oregon and across the country to the brink. A new report from the Endangered Species Coalition highlights 10 of the nearly 1,200 species imperiled by these chemicals. In the Northwest, pesticide runoff hampers the swimming ability of Chinook salmon. It also enters their fatty tissue, poisoning the main source of nutrition for the endangered southern resident orcas. Lorianne Bird, with the Center for Biological Diversity in Oregon, says Trump administration policies are exacerbating the pesticide problem.
They've changed the risk thresholds for exposure to children based on requests from industry. They've scrapped reports looking at the impacts of pesticides on endangered species. They are rolling back protections from pesticides left and right.
The report also features the northern spotted owl, birds that are eating rats poisoned with rodenticides, and the streaked horned lark being killed off by seeds treated with pesticide. Only about 2,000 streaked horned larks remain. Bird notes some of these pesticides are harmful to humans as well. Chlorpyrifos, a chemical used on crops like alfalfa, cotton, and grapes, has been linked to brain damage and other health problems in children. The Obama administration proposed a federal ban on the chemical in 2015, but the Environmental Protection Agency recently reversed that decision. The Trump administration says science is inconclusive on the chemical's dangers. In response, Bird says states are taking action, including California, which banned chlorpyrifos in early October.
One thing that's interesting is because the federal government has been so bad on pesticides in recent years, states and local municipalities have really stepped up, and so people can support those efforts on the local level.
The report notes pesticide use is widespread. According to the most recent data from the EPA, nearly $9 billion worth of pesticides were used in 2012 across the country. For KBOO Evening News and Oregon News Service, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Natural gas, while a cleaner source of energy than coal, is still a significant source of carbon pollution. Some localities have moved to ban the energy source in new buildings. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the U.S., furnaces, water heaters, and stoves often burn natural gas. Though better for the climate than oil or coal, it's still a significant source of carbon pollution. Kate Harrison is a city council member in Berkeley, California. She was surprised to learn that burning natural gas in buildings produced more than a quarter of her city's greenhouse gas emissions.
Generally, when people think about climate change, they think about cars and factories. So I was stunned to find out that this large proportion was coming out of residences, offices, etc. That motivated us to look at how we could tackle that issue.
So she helped pass a new law in Berkeley. Starting next year, the city will ban the use of natural gas in new residential buildings under 5 stories. The law will eventually apply to larger buildings and commercial construction, too. New buildings will use electricity rather than gas. This switch can have a big impact in cities like Berkeley, because most of their electricity comes from renewable sources. Berkeley's law is the first in the U.S., but dozens of cities are considering similar laws. Harrison says when cities commit to taking action, rapid change is possible.
I think we just hit a tipping point, and now we're on the way.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
This weekend, the Burnside Bridge is closed for repairs and improvements. A new eastbound transit lane will be added to the bridge in the hopes of making bus travel quicker for riders on lines 12, 19, and 20. Officials say the closure could last until Monday, November 4th. Portland City Commissioner Chloe Udaly, who oversees the Bureau of Transportation, told KPTV, quote, "The new eastbound transit-only lane will increase the speed and reliability of bus service. Overall, these improvements will make walking, biking, or taking public transit across the Burnside Bridge a more attractive option for thousands of Portlanders," end quote. While the bridge is closed, the Steel Bridge and the Morrison Bridge will serve as alternative routes, with buses being rerouted onto the Steel Bridge.
Coalition Brewing closed yesterday. The 9-year-old Portland brewery sold its business to a new company, Gorge's Beer Company. Coalition Brewery opened in 2010 with a focus on pub-style beers. They became the first brewery to make CBD-infused beers in 2016. Gorge's Beer Company plans on reopening the Southeast Portland Brewery and Taproom, but they have not announced when. Gorge's staff includes the former head brewer from the recently closed Lompoc Brewery. The company has long-term plans to build a brewery in Cascade Locks and feature barrel-aged, fruited, and experimental beers.
Amid local tensions regarding the unionization of Portland restaurants, Scotty's Pizza has joined the ranks of the Industrial Workers of the World. Employees signed a petition in late September announcing their intent to join the union. Scotty's Pizza's owner, Scotty Rivera, welcomed the move and told Willamette Week, quote, "From day one of opening shop, I've told my employees that I would voluntarily recognize their union," end quote. Rivera has been intent on providing his employees with competitive wages and benefits upon the pizzeria's opening in 2015. IWW, whose members are known as Wobblies, is a 112-year-old labor union based in Chicago. Rivera's wife is a longtime IWW member and has helped organize PSU's Graduate Employees Union. The Scotties Union does not have pressing demands, but is expecting to negotiate a first collective bargaining agreement in the months to come. The restaurant's unionization follows the recent strike at Burgerville and a rejected unionization attempt at Little Big Burger.
The Multnomah County Health Department has confirmed a case of whooping cough at a Portland high school this week. The case was reported at Grant High School on Thursday. A letter was issued to students warning of the illness, urging families to make sure their vaccines are current. Whooping cough, or pertussis, causes severe violent coughing that can last for weeks. It is a respiratory infection, and it is highly contagious. Health officials say the most common age group to contract the illness are kids age 5 to 9, although all ages are susceptible. Vaccination proves to be the most effective prevention. Early symptoms of a runny nose and a low-grade fever progress to full-blown fits of exhaustive coughing within 1 to 3 weeks of infection. The coughing fits may last up to 10 weeks. In China, pertussis is known as the 100-day cough. There have been 61 confirmed cases of whooping cough in Multnomah County this year.
A new Washington bill would restore voting rights for people released from prison. As a result, voting rights could expand to about 21,000 Washingtonians in community custody, with the legislation coming to the State House in 2020. Eric Tegahoff has more.
While many Washingtonians with felony convictions had their voting rights restored a decade ago, barriers and confusion remain. A bill in next year's legislative session aims to rectify that. Democratic Senator Patty Cooterer of Bellevue wants to allow people in community custody, known as on parole in many states, to vote. The former prosecutor says punishment for breaking the law is supposed to deter crime.
I don't think that taking away someone's right to vote fits the crime. And I say that because there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that taking away someone's right to vote has a deterrent effect on the commission of crime.
Cooterer notes restrictions on voting rights for people who have been in prison has its roots in Jim Crow, a set of laws enacted in the early 20th century to enforce racial segregation. About 21,000 Washingtonians are in community custody, according to the State Department of Corrections. Kudrer says she's spoken with many formerly incarcerated people who are unsure about their voting eligibility. She hopes the new bill can simplify the law in a number of ways. The original bill passed a decade ago, restoring rights for people who were convicted of felonies, allows folks to register once they have paid off their legal debts. But Kudrer believes a person's voting rights should not be connected to legal financial obligations.
Tying your right to vote to repayment of those obligations is nothing more than a poll tax.
David Elliott, a spokesperson for the Secretary of State, told lawmakers as far as he knows, no one has had their voting rights taken away because of legal fees or fines. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, The Struggle. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear with a low of 36 degrees. Tomorrow, expect to see sunny skies with highs around 60. Today in history, in 1955, the Vietnam War began. It would last until April 30th, 1975. Estimates as to the number of casualties from all sides of the war, including civilians, number between 1 and 4 million. The quote of the day is from Martin Luther King Jr., who said of the war, quote, "The war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit."
Today, Democratic presidential candidates are going to Iowa for the Iowa Democratic Party annual fundraiser, all the while money and polling troubles weigh on some of their campaigns. Lily Bulkley has more with this story and others with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
Nobody comes to Congress to impeach a president. You come about the future, about our children, about issues you care about, whether it's education, climate, you name it, gun safety. So nobody comes for that. But we do take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution. And when that is under threat, we cannot ignore it.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi in Iowa recently. Yesterday, she echoed that sentiment, telling reporters it was a sad day. For only the fourth time in history, the House formalized the impeachment inquiry by an almost party-line vote. Joining the Republican bloc voting against it were Democratic Representatives Colin Peterson of Minnesota and Jeff Van Drew of New Jersey. Tonight, 14 Democratic primary candidates will be at the Iowa Democratic Party's major fundraiser of the year, the Liberty and Justice Celebration. It's a major event, starting off the final stretch of Iowa caucus season, and candidates need to draw supportive crowds. Here's Beto O'Rourke.
And I want to invite you to be my guest. Follow the link below, sign up, join us.
This week, California Senator Kamala Harris cut staff to save money. All the candidates have been spending more than they're raising, except Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, Andrew Yang, and Tom Steyer, who's largely self-funded. The pressure is intense. Brendan Quinn of the Center for Responsive Politics points out some of the practical costs.
A lot of them are spending a decent amount of money on, you know, paying their staff and other sort of interests related to keeping their campaign running, like they have to pay for office space and to keep the lights on in that office space and to keep their employees.
With New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary 1 week after the Iowa caucus, candidates are hard-pressed to share resources in all the early states. Former Vice President Joe Biden has taken heat this week from supporters worried about his dropping New Hampshire poll numbers, despite having 10 offices and 50 staff on the ground. Quinn added that candidates spend a lot on research, just figuring out where to put the money.
If the Democrats are looking at the primary states, spending money on polling and research, saying, hey, maybe we probably shouldn't devote too many resources to South Carolina because the voters there don't like us as much, but we should focus on Nevada because that's another early voting state where they do like us.
That's one less expense for candidates. All of the Democrats have been spending far more money on Facebook ads anyway, Forbes reported, ads that do not have to be truthful. Here's Iowa's GOP communications director, Aaron Britt.
I think, you know, it came as a little bit of a surprise, but honestly, I think it's going to hurt the Democrats more than it hurts us.
given that President Trump's Twitter account has over 66 million followers and the closest Democratic challenger is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders with almost 10 million, the ads may not matter as much as the platform itself. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Just hours ahead of this important fundraising dinner in Iowa, former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke has announced he is ending his 2020 presidential campaign. In an email to supporters, O'Rourke said he will not run for office next year, despite some pleas from Democrats to take on Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn. In a statement, he said, quote, "Though it is difficult to accept, it is clear to me now that this campaign does not have the means to move forward successfully," end quote. O'Rourke is the ninth candidate to drop out of the Democratic primary, leaving behind a still crowded field of candidates.
Oregon currently has 35 inmates on death row, though the moratorium on death penalty still stands as it has since 1997. In other parts of the nation, conservatives are calling for the end of the death penalty. Critics of the death penalty say the cost to taxpayers can be as much as 10 times the cost of seeking a sentence of life in prison without the possibility for parole. Eric Galatis has more.
This week, more than 250 conservatives from Wyoming and 43 other states, including Republican State Representative Jared Olson of Cheyenne, signed a statement calling for an end to the death penalty. The move comes as the Trump administration plans to resume federal executions. Kylie Taylor, with the Wyoming chapter of conservatives concerned about the death penalty, calls capital punishment a wasteful, ineffective, and error-prone government program that goes against core conservative principles.
Republican state lawmakers are introducing legislation to repeal the death penalty. It's very expensive. It's a failed government program, and it doesn't value life.
Taylor says as soon as prosecutors announce they'll seek the death penalty, costs to taxpayers can increase by as much as 10 times the cost of lesser sentences. Proponents of the death penalty say it's an important deterrent and that jurors should have an option to impose what many see as a just and appropriate sentence for the worst crimes committed. Taylor believes life in prison without the possibility for parole is also a reasonable and significant punishment, and points to studies showing that the death penalty has not been an effective deterrent. Taylor is also not comfortable with authorizing any government to execute its citizens.
The risk of executing an innocent person is very, very real. 1 out of 10 inmates on death row are later exonerated, which is huge. That number alone should be alarming.
The Wyoming legislature considered a bill to repeal the death penalty in the last session, but the measure did not clear the Senate. There are currently no inmates on Wyoming's death row. Taylor says a growing number of state legislatures are considering banning capital punishment. So far, 22 U.S. states have abolished the death penalty. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
The North Carolina legislature has finally addressed a glaring loophole in their sexual assault laws. They passed new legislation yesterday that overturned a 40-year-old law which stated that women could not revoke consent once they had started having sex. The legislation also overturned a 2008 North Carolina Supreme Court decision that said sexual assault laws did not apply to victims who were incapacitated because of their own actions, such as drinking or taking drugs. The legislation was a far-reaching bill that gained bipartisan support.
This week, the news broke that the Keystone Pipeline spilled in South Dakota just as hearings on said pipeline commence. With that story and more, it's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. South Dakota's Water Management Board is holding hearings on the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, as news broke this week that the Keystone pipeline spilled in North Dakota. Reports say more than 380,000 gallons of oil spilled before containment. South Dakota State Senator Troy Heiner told the board Thursday he's concerned about potential damage from a spill to the agriculture and tourism industries. Victoria Wicks reports.
Troy Heinert is a member of the Senate Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. He's also a rancher and enrolled member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. He says the Department of Environment and Natural Resources doesn't have enough employees who can go out into the field to inspect sites where problems have been reported. Heinert says DENR hasn't seen an increase in full-time employee positions in 14 years.
I would hope that we get more dedicated professionals like we have who are out there representing the people of South Dakota and the state of South Dakota, and looking at these applications and or lines that are already built with objective eyes.
Heinert says he has constituents in his district who support the pipeline and others who don't. He says he listens to all, but as a rancher, he knows the importance of clean water.
Without water, you don't have livestock. You don't have crops.
He says the Miniwichoni Water Project in particular has opened up grazing range for him and for his ranching constituents.
It has changed their life and changed how they can operate.
Heinert says he's concerned that the oil pipeline crosses over the water pipeline and a disaster could make that water unusable. The Water Management Board has added 4 more days in December for hearings in Pierre. Because opponent witnesses have been allowed to cut in line because they're not available later, TC Energy still has not completed its case in chief. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The Fort Peck tribe swore in a new tribal government this week. As Olivia Reingold reports, tribal members re-elected their incumbent chairman.
Chairman Floyd Azure won a third consecutive term with a more than 10% margin of victory on a platform of education.
We're not moving this country forward unless we get our people educated.
One thing getting in the way, he says teachers don't have enough leeway to discipline their students.
Now all they do is put you in timeout. What the heck is timeout?
He says there wouldn't be such a respect problem in schools if teachers could discipline their students more. He says the respect issue is a societal problem, but there are things the tribes can do, like send students to truancy court. It's a program he says he started as chairman.
As long as I'm chairman, we're going to do that. We got to get those kids to school. We have to get them educated.
Azure joins a tribal council with 5 new members, 1 new associate judge, and 13 incumbents. For National Native News, I'm Olivia Reingold in Billings, Montana.
Plaintiffs in the Yazzie Martinez lawsuit, which includes Native American students in New Mexico, are calling on the state to develop and fund a long-term plan to meet the needs of students. Attorneys for the plaintiffs say there's been not enough action in more than a year since the state was found to be violating the rights of students in public school by not providing them with the opportunity to be college and career ready, especially low-income, students of color, English language learners, and students with disabilities. The state was ordered in 2018 to take immediate action to overhaul the education system. A motion was filed this week asking the court to order the state to create a plan within 60 days and to take action no later than March. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
New York City announced plans to build 250 new bike lanes and add 1 million square feet of pedestrian space by 2021. Proponents of the legislation said it was part of a plan to, quote, break the car culture of the city. The Streets Master Plan is focused on improving safety for pedestrians and cyclists. It is part of a $1.7 billion investment and will also increase protected bike lanes, redesign intersections, and install accessible pedestrian signals at 2,500 intersections. The number of cyclists who ride more than a few times per month has increased 26% between 2012 and 2017. The number of deaths is up by 24% this year. In addition to making the city safer, the plan is also focused on addressing climate change by reducing reliance on cars and increasing alternative transportation.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 1st, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade and Kevin Duggan. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Althea Billings. Stay tuned for Counterspin. We'll be right back.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Muertos PDX Dia de los Muertos celebration on Friday, November 1st and Saturday, November 2nd from 4 to 9 p.m. at St. Andrew Catholic Church in Portland. This two-day event celebrates the ancient tradition of welcoming back loved ones who have passed on. There will be altar building, Muertos face painting, sugar skull decorating, traditional Mexican food, drink, and live musical performances. It's a benefit for Transiciones, a program at Mount Hood Community College that has helped Latino women for close to 20 years in reaching their academic and career goals. Again, that's the Muertos PDX Dia de los Muertos celebration on Friday, November 1st and Saturday, November 2nd from 4 to 9 p.m. at St. Andrew Catholic Church, 806 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, people are using words like unlivable to describe parts of California, where wildfires and power outages are driving new kinds of crisis and exacerbating existing ones. At the heart of it, climate disruption, of course, but also a private utility system that isn't now and never has been incentivized to address it. As we record the show, young Californians are sitting in at Nancy Pelosi's office saying business as usual is over. Media should be looking forward, too. But will they? We'll talk about the drive for a publicly owned, community-controlled energy system with Johanna Bozua, co-manager of the Climate and Energy Program at the Democracy.